Kevin Roberts is, I suppose you might call, a transatlantic Kiwi. Born in Britain, he became something of a marketing genius, rising to become head of marketing for Lion Nathan, among other things, before going into advertising, starting at the top as Saatchi & Saatchi's worldwide CEO. He's an innovator, some say the ultimate in creative, boundless thinking. A few years ago, he came up with the idea of New Zealand on the Edge, but it was a bit too edgy for the tourism board here, and they settled instead for the rather more limpid 100% pure brand. Over the last few years, Kevin has come up with the concept of the Love Mark, the brand beyond conventional branding. He's published two books about it all. But what exactly is a Love Mark? I asked him.
A brand that builds an emotional connection with a consumer. It takes it out of being just another commodity that's sold on, you know, the same boring kind of promises of benefits and attributes. And it moves from being irreplaceable, if you like, to becoming irresistible, right? A bit like Dan Carter.
Yeah. So it's a brand with emotion attached.
There you go. It's a brand that's kind of pumped full of mystery, sensuality and intimacy. If New Zealand, you know, the country, you know, were a little better known by many people, it would be a love mark, I think. Once you've been to New Zealand, you know, you love the stories, you love the history, you love the Maori, you love the rugby, you love the food, you love the wine, you love, you know, all this stuff. It's a very kind of love mark place. So New Zealand would be a love mark. Poland probably might not be.
Yeah, or Belgium, for instance.
Or Belgium, yes.
Or Switzerland. But
yeah, you're onto it.
Well, a few
Australia.
Years ago, yeah, well, we better not go there. A few years ago, you talked about New Zealand on the edge, and you wanted the tourism industry to market New Zealand, in fact, New Zealand to market itself as a country on the edge. How does that square with the notion of what you've just been talking about?
I think that edge is the mystery. You know, how can these New Zealanders be so good at so much stuff? How can they win all these Oscars? Where do these cloudy bays come from? Where do these number 10s come from? You know, there's plenty of edgy mystery about the place. I mean, it's viewed as being very cool and contemporary now, particularly by, you know, Americans and Europeans. So I think the New Zealand edge is what makes us so distinctive. It is what adds to our mystery in today's times.
How does the 100% pure strap line shape up in that respect?
I mean, I think really the most important thing that's happened to our tourism has been Peter Jackson, Lord of the Rings, quite frankly, and then shooting all these movies down here, backed up by the great wines and by the new resorts. I think New Zealand Pure has been a, if you like, a holding reassurance, trust and kind of respect kind of thing, but it hasn't been edgy enough really to make the difference. I think our creative industries have made that difference for us.
You don't think that consumers will be emotionally moved by that kind of message? And you say that that's the absolute essential.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with the message, when you look at the visuals and the graphics, there is it could be Denmark, it could be Ireland, it could be Canada, it could be Scotland. Plus, the claim of purity, you know, actually isn't true. And isn't that
don't
terribly
spread,
aspirational?
Don't spread that around, for goodness sake.
I think the thing that makes the difference to a New Zealand holiday are New Zealanders. You know, you come here and you're really welcomed. And the people are fun, and they invite you out for a beer, they invite you down to the footy, they'll invite you down to a great vineyard. And there's a fantastic story to be told about our people. I think the biggest issue, though, Chris, on tourism, frankly, is that the government doesn't spend enough money on promoting it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just get our messages get lost, you know. Australia, you know, outspend us enormously. All these other countries outspend us. And we really need to lift a game, I think, on that, because to my mind, you know, the two critical things for New Zealand are exports and tourism.
You say that the inspirational consumer has started a revolution and only companies that have reached love mark status will survive. What is the inspirational consumer?
Well, first of all, she's a she.
Oh, really?
Speaking. And she's hooked up on the internet and she's hooked up on the mobile. And she is now playing a role of connector, right? Her biggest, you know, as soon as she hears some news, the first thing she does is she goes onto her computer and emails her 25 closest friends. Then she calls them all up and she starts to spread the word. And these inspirational consumers are now really dictating the world because they've got as much information as we have. There's no place to hide now. Everybody has information and knowledge come out of their ears. So they really, consumers now, are really in power. We've seen power switch really from brands through to retailers. And now it's you, me, you know, Mrs. Jones in the street, who holds the power. And I think the brands that succeed will be those brands who can relinquish control and let the consumers participate and interact.
How then does the advertising industry commune with that inspirational consumer?
Interactively rather than directionally. You know, David Ogilvy, who's a great ad guy, once said, "The consumer is not a moron, she's your wife." And most of the current advertising still tends to treat consumers, you know, moronically. You know, if you look at a lot of mobile phone, you know, or the sales stuff, you know, watch the rugby in New Zealand, and you're inundated with messages about price, value, and sale till you can't bear it anymore. And consumers are way beyond that. They understand now that prices have got to be low and prices have got to generate value. What is that that shows empathy to the consumer, that shows understanding of the consumer's feelings? You know, most research is designed to figure out what consumers say and do, and of course they lie all the time. The advertising that matters now is advertising that is emotionally connected to consumers' feelings.
Yes.
Which means the agencies that will win are those, and the brands that will win are those that can move on from information and knowledge, which we're all drowning in, and develop insight and foresight, which is much harder work.
Yeah, well, I guess it is for the ad agencies. Give us some examples of companies that have transformed their connection with the consumer into an emotional one.
I think a very good one is Apple. And if you remember, you know, Apple had years and years of profit pressures and problems and so on.
Yes.
And then Steve Jobs and Jonathan Ive designed and invented the iPod. Now, they got a 75% share, and they've changed the music industry forever. And they did that through really moving from the insight that consumers wanted freedom to choose their own music. They wanted mobility. They wanted to have the music wherever they want. And then they had the foresight to design this incredibly intimate, sensuous thing called the iPod. You know, any other MP3 player, it's cheaper than the iPod. Probably the batteries last longer. And you wouldn't be seen dead with one,
right? Yeah.
Because the iPod's irresistible. He did that first with computers, with the iMac, right? He took computers out of being gray, black, and square into being objects of beautiful desire and passion. And if you look at the profits that Apple make now, I mean, they've quadrupled over the last couple of years because of that.
Is it no coincidence that there's a heart on the Apple computer?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's driven completely by people rather than by technology, right? I mean, technology now is just an enabler. I mean, if you just look at the Time Person of the Year was you. YouTube's kind of the biggest website you can find. Trade Me. All these things are about interactive networks, communities of consumers exercising power. So advertisers and brands to flourish in that business have got to become closer to consumers than they've ever been. Because the mass market's dead. You know, everybody now is a consumer, a market of one. So it's a pretty exciting period to be alive in this business.
If it's a market of one, how does the mass appeal of television, for instance, work? If we're all looking for a different kind of product, how can television reach us all individually?
Yeah, television will be the most important medium still for a number of reasons. First, everybody's got one, or kind of got three, really.
Yeah.
Everybody knows how to use it. And the TV guy, the channels have got smarter and smarter, so they're really targeting us with key programs. I mean, I watch the rugby channel all the time. Who can imagine, a channel devoted only to rugby? I mean, it's a fantastic thing. I mean, that's virtually a market of one, right?
Yes.
They do a lot of live shows, and you've got to watch live shows because if not, you know, what do you talk about in the office next morning if you didn't watch the live show? Reality TV is a market of one because everybody wants to intrude and put themselves into that situation, you know, Big Brother and so on. All these pop idol shows are all about you know, dragging individual consumers up, and they're irresistible. So you're seeing the TV adapt to this market of one. I still think it's very, very powerful.
Is there a concern in any of this about quality? I mean, it's easy to sell a product on the basis of an emotional attachment. Where does quality figure in all of this?
Yeah, love marks are built on two things. First of all, respect, and then love. So quality, price, value, trust, reputation are incredibly important, and you must have them as a foundation. Okay, but love, we think, is built on that foundation. Most products today are pretty good quality. I mean, most shampoos get your hair soft and clean. Most moisturizers make your skin soft. Most beer tastes good, unless you live in America like me. But generally speaking, these things all work nowadays because the low-quality stuff's disappeared. You know, the market has killed the low quality. So you've got to have quality, you've got to have distribution, you've got to have price, and that's not enough. They're survival strategies, not growth strategies.
How big, how important in all this grand matrix of factors is sustainability, the quality of the product in terms of its integrity?
I think it's the single hottest topic that consumers are going to make decisions on over the next 5 years.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually the professor of sustainable enterprise at the University of Waikato, and I'm just working now on a book about how the winners are going to be those companies that do not indulge in greenwashing, because there's a hell of a lot of that going on right now, but that really do have a point of view on the environment, have a point of view on social side of things, culture and side of things, as well as economic.
But is the consumer aware of that? I mean, are we tuned in well enough yet? You say within 5 years it'll be the dominating factor, but we still seem to be a long way off it.
Yeah, well, I think you always have been. So, I mean, I think there's a bunch of people, you know, on the liberal side of life that have been talking about this for many years. I think the new generation coming up are looking at global warming. They're looking at what's happening to the environment. They're looking at what's happening socially to people living at home. They're looking at this globalization versus local. And they're saying, mate, we don't want to do that. We want to indulge in the global when it suits us. But boy, we really want to be part of a community that really has sustainability at its core. So I'm seeing it in all our research, in all our data, as moving from kind of underlying eighth or ninth to top three. You're seeing Walmart now, you know, Walmart, the world's biggest company, Lee Scott, the CEO, absolutely talking about sustainability at every level. And the interesting thing is that he's trying to get his employees engaged as a first step, and I think that's seriously smart.
Well, Stephen Tindall doing the same thing.
Absolutely right.
Here.
You know, and doing it from the bottom up, Chris, is what appeals to me. I think, you know, this is not going to be done by the UN or by governments or by big corporates. Anyway, there's not that many big corporates left in New Zealand, right? It's going to be done by us, by people, making a difference, by consumers, and by creating small, you know, sustainable enterprises.
How much of a love mark are the All Blacks?
I think they are one of the greatest example. I mean, the definition of a love mark for me is loyalty beyond reason.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a rumor around that we haven't won this funny thing, the World Cup, for 20 years.
More than a rumor.
I think, unfortunately, there's some substance to that. Okay, so the Poms will enjoy the next 8 months because then it's all going to turn black for them. But I think that throughout the world, even Stephen Jones is beginning to say that, yep, the All Blacks embody mystery. They are certainly, there's a lot of sensuality around it, particularly
yes.
with the haka and so on, and the black. And there's a lot of intimacy on it because when you go out now and meet the All Blacks and talk to them, they are incredibly approachable, touchable, believable, incredible, unlike, you know, for instance, Premier League soccer players and so on. Seems to me, you know, you've been an All Black, you're part of the family, you're part of that legacy, and there is a aura of respect and indeed love, even in South Africa, for the All Blacks.
Mm.
I think the nearest other sporting team to them is the Brazilian soccer team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're a love mark to everybody. I mean, they may not, you know, not be your first favorite team, but they're everybody's second favorite team.
Well, they pack the stadium, and that's...
Yeah, they are wherever they go.
Yeah.
And so with the All Blacks, you know. I mean, the All Blacks play anywhere, you get a full house.
The worry that some people have is that the commodification of professional sports means that it loses its emotional connection with the consumer. But you're saying that in the case of the All Blacks, for instance, it's lifted beyond that because of the aura of sensuality.
And of your history, you know, 105 years of history, and of all the great All Blacks and all the legacy that you blokes have created and carried forward. But I do think the game rugby, you know, in this professional era, has really to watch out. You know, I mean, I think in New Zealand, you know, Super 10 to Super 12 to Super 14, it's not that super anymore.
No.
You know, the players must be bored to tears going to South Africa for the fifth time in 5 years, you know. Tri Nations, playing South Africa and Australia three times, enough already.
Well, how do you sustain the mystery? I mean, there is a point at which you over-egg that pudding, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think we've reached that point. I mean, I really believe we need to start wrapping the All Blacks back into mystery, play 11, 12 times a year. We need to be, you know, making sure that the British Lions continue, because I think the British Lions are a love mark, even despite the disastrous performance last time round.
Yeah.
I think we need to be playing full-strength Northern Hemisphere sides, you know. I hope France, and if they know who their number 10 is by then, I don't know, but I mean, Laporte's played, I think, 27 different combinations, but you know, I think Ireland should send their, you know, their best side.
Sure.
And then I think on this, you know, we've got to be rethinking now, you know, the whole question of the Tri Nations, really, of how many times we play these sides.
Yes, Kevin Roberts, he's right, you know, he's right about that. Love Marks Beyond Brands is his book.